Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, with my co-host here, Dr. Carl. We're in the We are in the same square.
Trying to squish together.
Because we're visiting each other. We did not go to the ADA conference, which is where our special guest is at right now, David White.
People don't even know what ADA is.
I know.
ADA. The American Diabetes Association.
But there is a dietetic. And so people are like, you're going to the ADA.
Dentists.
David White, he's a nurse practitioner, and he is, well, I would say second most, he is a nerd when it comes to glucagon and GIP.
Look at his shirt.
You can see if you're on, he has a shirt that's talking about glucagon agonism. And that is a topic for today, because we're going to be talking about retatrutide, or as some people say, retatrutide, tomato, tomato, I believe. And that's a story for another day. But first and foremost, David was in the trial that we're going to be talking about, right? David, you were actually in this trial.
Triumph One. Yes.
So he has been talking about this online, about his experience, and then also about the pharmacology of these medicines. So welcome to the show, David. It's great
Thanks to finally have you on.
We chat all the time. We text back and forth, and you're quite an incretin nutrient stimulating hormone shill, as I would say. So thanks for coming.
Yeah. No problem. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm interested to learn a little bit more about your background. And I know, you know, we want to keep it relatively short before we get into what the heck this stuff is and what these, the finally, the big phase three trials being published are. But so I want to hear your little story, how you got into this.
So I was in nurse practitioner school a few years back. I did my master's thesis on how GLP-1 meds act both centrally and peripherally, like, you know, basically how it's using vagal nerve afferent vagal nerve feedback, yada yada. Won't get into that. It just so happened one of the lead investigators for the phase two trial was in town, and my preceptor at the time for family medicine was like, hey, you want to talk to him, you know? And so I talked to him, and he was like, you know, hey, we're recruiting for phase three right now. If you want to lose some weight, give this site a call. So I called the site, and kind of the rest is history. My BMI was about 34, almost 35, and now sitting here, my BMI is 24. So I was one of the, as we'll get to, I was one of the patients that got under 25 in the trial. That was one of the exploratory endpoints. Yeah. So
very cool.
Well, yeah. So tell us, we've talked about this in previous podcasts, what it is, mm-hmm. you know, the triple G, the triple agonist therapy. We've talked about some phase two trials, I think. And our friend Anya presented this and is presumably the first author on one of the trials, the phase three trials that was published that you're going to talk about. But can you give us just a little background as to what they are, what the theories are, why the triple agonism helps with weight and with diabetes and hopefully more cardiometabolic disease that comes from obesity? And how we got to this point.
Yeah. I mean, so I think the easiest thing is most people know what tirzepatide is. So they know about GLP-1, tirzepatide adds GIP, which seems to help with weight loss in an additive manner. And then also seems to help with fat targeting, it seems. And then glucagon itself, they gave a whole intro lecture yesterday, basically saying, what is this adding? And, you know, so it's adding insulin sensitivity, it's adding catabolism of lipids directly, so which you see in the data in terms of triglycerides and cholesterol. There's a question as to whether it adds increased energy and expenditure or not. That's still an open question. And
that's been the thought historically, the little bit of maybe increased metabolic rate, but more of that direct, right, like literal fat metabolism sort of thing.
Yeah. And differently from GLP-1 and GIP, glucagon is expressed most heavily in the liver. So you get a little more peripheral action. And then it's also expressed in the kidney. So, some blood pressure lowering effects, as well. So that's kind of the quick and dirty backstory with why you're adding glucagon. So
quickly tell the audience, so semaglutide is a pure GLP-1 receptor agonist. Yep. Tirzepatide though, is it like you said, GLP-1/GIP, but it's a synthesized, it's not even based off of human GLP-1. It's more looks like GIT.
It's GIP, yeah.
But they kind of make it hit the receptors of both.
It's one molecule, but then dual agonist.
But then natrutide is kind of similar to that. It's based off more of a GIP backbone where they then create these molecules.
Yeah. Yeah, I
not that patients necessarily.
No,
care
it's
about
just
that.
Kind of, but they might think it's interesting. I don't know.
Yeah, it is basically. What I like to say is you know, retatrutide is kind of like the first cousin of tirzepatide because they're both GIP backbones. And when you look at the, you know, if you get nerdy and look at the amino acid sequence, there are about, I want to say it's like 80 or 85% similar. There's just a couple tweaks to get you the glucagon action. I believe there's three changes specifically that give it glucagon action. And, if you delete any of those, then it basically turns into high powered tirzepatide. So
that's awesome. Okay. So why don't we talk about how did you feel when you took retatrutide, retatrutide? I don't know what people like.
They said retatrutide all day yesterday. Right, so, there.
Okay. Side story. So Novo is the one that kind of, you know, liraglutide, and semaglutide, but Lilly calls what we would say dulaglutide as dulaglutide,
right?
But they call it tirzepatide, not tirzepatide.
They put the emphasis on the different syllable.
Rick's CEO calls it retatrutide.
Yeah.
There clearly other people call it retatrutide, and I asked them directly, and they said, "Well, it's mixed." I said, I asked my Novo people and they're like, no, we stick with the semaglutide. And tomato, tomato, potato, potato. Yeah, it doesn't matter. Anyway,
it's going to end up with a brand name that we don't know yet. So
yeah.
So
So let's hear your story. You jumped in, went into trial.
Yeah. I will start at the beginning. So I asked to be unblinded at the end. I ended up being on the 12 milligram group. So just for that point of reference. I guess the easiest way is just side effects. You know, I had the usual GI side effects the first, basically through dose escalation, which is about 5 months. There's 2, 4, 6, 9, 12. So yeah, first 5, 6 months, very mild nausea. Mostly it was, loose stools, and actually heartburn. That was probably my worst one was heartburn. And, you know, just a little, 20 milligram of Pepcid basically took care of that. But then once I hit that kind of steady dose, everything kind of dropped away. So by month 7, I was just like, oh, I'm not as hungry. I hate to say it was boring, but really after month 7, you know, it was just like, okay, like I'm not like I would really get appetite suppression for about 24 hours after a dose, and then I was kind of, I don't want to say back to normal, but had quasi normal hunger signals and just kind of, you know, very prolonged satiety and early satiety.
So that's good.
Which is exactly how it's supposed to work.
What we hope. Yeah.
Normalizing appetite as opposed to eliminate it. What was your starting weight? You said 34.
Yeah. So I was 240 pounds when I started. I ended the trial. I think I was 167. And I'm about 175 now. So,
like 30% weight loss or so.
Yeah. Yeah. Right at the 30% mark. So
amazing. Somebody still knows math.
Yeah. Yeah. Right around. That's a good average.
That's very good. Yeah.
That's right. So where we see the average.
We'll talk about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very cool. And then when you stopped the trial, did you go on anything different? Cause you couldn't get the.
Yeah. Yeah. Just terzepatide, which
plain old terzepatide.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did it
feel?
How did it feel the difference?
That's a good experience.
Not much different. I'm just one of those people that I feel like everyone talks about the side effects and not about the fact that for most people do tolerate the drugs really, really well.
Yeah.
You know, and so I'm like, okay, same thing. I get the reduced appetite and then don't eat as much, you know?
and when you go through the data, I mean, we can talk about, you know, the percentage of side effects that are reported, but I always like when I do the educational talks to doctors, I talk about, well, how many people dropped out of the trial due to the side effects? And even then they're being forced to titrate up like you were. But I also, it's an interesting point that I think a lot of people have talked about in your case. Obviously, you knew you were not in the placebo arm.
Right. Yeah. It's hard to stay blinded when you just dump weight so fast. So.
All right. So should we start with the triumph then? Because we have two big trials that were presented at ADA. One of them did get simultaneously published. The other one I suspect will, but it's public now, so it doesn't matter. We can talk about it, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I will say with the Triumph data, they kind of cautioned and said, we've only had this data for 2 weeks. So we worked through the night to try and get as much, to be able to present as possible because, people ask some deeper questions and they're like, look, we're still chewing on the data. This was just the bare minimum to get a presentation out.
So what was it? What was
probably
Triumph,
later this
basically.
Summer?
What's the background of Triumph? This is not diabetes.
Yeah. So this was 80. This was an 80-week trial with a 24-week extension for certain patients. It was what they call a basket trial because it was obesity, but also had knee osteoarthritis and an OSA as well. Patients. And then so primary outcomes were weight loss at 80 weeks. And then if you were in the extension trial, weight loss at 104 weeks. And so that was kind of, that regular obesity trial for GLP-1 these days.
Do you know do you have the basic baseline characteristics sort of up?
I do. So baseline characteristics, average BMI was 40. So, we're talking, and I was 35, so I was actually under that, but average BMI was 40. Participants of patients with BMI greater than 35 was 77%. I was trying to find the percentage of female. I think it was about 65% female.
Pretty typical, right?
Yeah. Nothing really outstanding. They did have more Native American patients than you'd normally see, and that was just partially where the sites were. Otherwise, pretty well balanced across.
Yeah. Do you have pulled up the percentage of people who had some sort of criteria of pre-diabetes? So again, this one is without type 2 diabetes.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that, but
36% pre-diabetic.
Pretty typical. Wow.
2,400, roughly 2,400 patients. So that was kind of our baseline characteristics.
And then what were the arms of the trial?
So arms were placebo, then 4 milligrams, 9 milligrams, 12 milligrams. I mentioned the dose escalation is 2 milligrams, 4 milligrams, 6 milligrams, 9 milligrams, and then 12. If the patients, about 500 patients got extended to 104 weeks, those are patients that had a baseline BMI of greater than 35. They were tolerating the medication well, and essentially still had weight to lose. And that was everyone. So even the placebo arm got crossed over, and it was max tolerated dose. So we can talk about that as well.
It was cool. I saw the graph of that. That was, you know, how everyone starts to meet up, and everyone tends to respond to it. So yeah, what are the kind of the bottom line upfront average weight losses of the groups?
Yeah. So at 80 weeks, with 4 milligrams, we saw 19% weight loss. 9 milligrams saw 26%, and then 12 milligrams saw 28.3%. And then if you look at the extension trial, so patients that stayed on 12 milligrams the whole time lost 30.3%. Patients that went from 9 to 12 went to 29%. Patients from 4 to 12 went to 28%. And then the placebo group in 24 weeks went to 19% weight loss.
Just
wild.
Yeah, that's outstanding. And again, I like to always reemphasize this for people listening. And we'll talk about the categorical weight loss next, how many people achieved 15, 20, yes, all that stuff. When we talk about some of the older medications, the old standard was 5% weight loss, because it's hard to do that with diet and exercise. And so it was, well, can medications help you achieve more than that? Because that's when we start to see some health benefits. Blood pressure, blood sugars, triglycerides, physical well-being. Now, we talk about 10's really kind of the standard. We should be able to achieve that with the types of therapies that we've had for a while now. But then, really 10, 15% and more weight loss is where we get the most health benefits. And that's what we actually care about. You know, I always say it's what's on the inside that counts. And, we're putting diabetes into remission, sleep apnea into remission, fatty liver with fibrosis going the right direction, physical well-being, knee arthritis. Well, and we're going to talk about the sleep apnea and the knee arthritis outcomes if we can. But that's just so people know, when we start getting over that much weight loss, that's where we get substantial clinical benefits that actually matter, hard benefits, cardiovascular risk reduction and all that stuff. And so, historically, I mean, like the average tirzepatide, Zepbound Mounjaro trials, it's like, 20-22%. If you don't have diabetes, with diabetes, you don't lose as much weight. And we can go over that in the next trial, but that's the context of how big of a deal this is.
Yeah. And I mean, to your point, so doing the categorical weight reductions at 80 weeks, I'm going to skip the 5% because it was almost
everybody, right?
It was almost everybody. But at 10%, 93%, of people had on the 9 or the 12 had lost 10%, and then you go, 20%, you had 3 out of 4 were still, hit 20%, almost half of the 4 milligram arm hit 20%. And that's one dose titration, and then, they pointed out we have 30 and 35% in their graphs, and you never see that before. And so almost 45% of people at week 80 were at 30% weight loss with the highest dose, and about 1 in 4 lost greater than 35% on the highest dose at 80 weeks. And you guys know that's bariatric surgery outcomes. So
some of the bariatric surgeons were like, whoa, hold on a second. We have made up to 5 years, but this is 2 years. It's probably durable just like the other one. So
yeah,
it looks good.
It doesn't mean bariatric surgery doesn't have a role, by the way. There's still a cost-effective aspect of it. I mean, I just saw another thing published about some retrospective analysis. There's still that, but still all the tools are good. And this is really, this medication is, going to be for those with more severe disease, I think. So
yeah.
How about the percentages of side effects? I looked at it quickly. It looked very similar to tirzepatide, maybe even lower side effect profile than say orforglipron, which is the pill that Lilly has.
I would almost break this down and say the 4 milligram is basically tirzepatide like side effects. Mm-hmm. And the 9 and the 12 are more like semaglutide. Just in terms of like raw rates of nausea and vomiting and diarrhea and whatnot. So
like a quarter of people get some nausea, right? 25 to 30%.
Yeah, about 25 to 30% get some nausea. It was up to 38-40% for the higher dose. But again, they pointed out you know, this was primarily during dose escalation, which it almost always is. And then there were a couple other kind of interesting things that popped out. There was a higher rate of UTIs reported. They're not quite sure why.
Hypothesis.
I mentioned this before. I've been talking about this for a few years. I get these patients, and you can see it on Reddit. Other people talked about it. I don't know if they're actually getting UTIs, if they're feeling like they have a UTI. And so,
because I think it depends on how it gets reported in the trials. I'll bet you they weren't doing white blood count bacteria urinalysis to confirm it.
I was just gonna say, I do primary care, and I'm like, is this asymptomatic bacteriuria that they're just treating because they've got the, you know, I mean, every time I went in, I had to give a urine sample. So they've got, you know, I had 20 some visits. So, you know, so it's like,
that would be good to know. Cause if they're doing, if it's that versus, I think they're having symptoms having symptoms of it. Then they don't check. And they're just like, okay, this patient had a UTI and they didn't actually do a culture.
And this is where the, you know, them only having the data for a couple of weeks, like hopefully I have like, again, is this from the site sampling? Is this patient's actually complaining? Like you know, more to come on that.
When it's truly published, hopefully we'll get more out of it.
Right. And then the other one that they pointed out and that I want to point out was dizziness and hypotension. And they specifically mentioned, they called this out basically saying, you know, we don't have the rate of patients that had to be dose reduced on high blood pressure medicine, but the dizziness and hypotension basically went hand in hand, and it was more common in patients with pre-existing hypertension.
Sure.
And it looks like it's probably because it's dropping blood pressure pretty profoundly.
So when we treat obesity-related high blood pressure medications are the, other than like type 2 diabetes, if they're on insulin or something, blood pressure meds are, to me, and I think statistically known, the first things we have to really pull back
on. Sure.
You know, it happens. High blood pressure is very sensitive to the disease of obesity.
That's also why I talk mad crap about the pill mills out there, because they don't they don't even treat it.
It's you have to have really good comprehensive care for these types of therapies. Honestly. I mean, just like we're going to talk about the diabetes trial. I mean, this is high intensity therapy. So
very good. All right. Well,
how many people dropped out of the trial due to those adverse reactions?
All right. So we'll break this down. Dropping out because of gastrointestinal side effects, 2% in the 4 milligram group, 4% in the 9 milligram group, 4.5% in the 12 milligram group.
That's not bad at all.
All told, you know, total treatment discontinuations, 4% in the 4 milligram, 7% in the 9 milligram, 11% in the 12 milligram. I think.
What's placebo?
And then placebo was 5% with treatment discontinuation. There was also a very large number of placebo patients that dropped out, period, just citing ineffective weight loss. Almost like a quarter of the placebo patients dropped out.
I'm not losing weight.
Yeah, that's also relatively typical.
I can't be on the drug.
Yeah.
There's no way.
Yeah.
All right.
You know, so and they did mention with the 12 milligram group, some of the treatment discontinuation was related to either excessive weight loss, so BMI less than 22, or perceived excessive weight loss. They didn't have the breakdown, again, early data. So.
And then any just kind of upfront results on the sleep apnea and the knee arthritis and any other, good weight related.
Yeah.
Benefits.
Yeah. So the two. So knee arthritis, 70% reduction in WOMAC pain score, which for those non-medical, that's just the pain score we use for knee arthritis. And then for sleep apnea, it was about a 60% reduction in sleep apnea events as we measure them.
How do those compare to the tirzepatide and semaglutide?
That's a little 60% is a little bit better, because that was about 50% in the two.
Yeah.
Tirzepatide
was about 50%. Yeah.
WOMAC. Yeah. What about the WOMAC for semaglutide and
tirzepatide? WOMAC for semaglutide.
I can't remember. We have to say.
No. Semaglutide WOMAC was like a 40% reduction. Yeah. So I mean, this is almost a doubling. And
that's great. I love it. So, yeah. Very good.
So and then cardiometabolic stuff. So I mentioned blood pressure 11 to 12 point drop in systolic, which again, and the baseline was 126. So, I mean, like,
you got to pull back those blood pressure meds.
Yeah.
I mean, don't go to one of these online BS places, just, you know, selling drugs. Yeah. Work with your physician, work with a good comprehensive team. You got to keep an eye on these things.
And then lipids, so 41% reduction in triglycerides with a baseline triglycerides of 121, 20% reduction in LDL with a baseline LDL of 113, 64% reduction in hsCRP with a baseline hsCRP of 4, and then about 92 to 95% of pre-diabetics reverted to normal glycemia. So, I mean, just profound. I mean, that's as good as Zetia.
Better than Zetia. It's a little bit better than Zetia. That's like a very low dose, or a low dose of like pravastatin or something like that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Now I've talked about this. This isn't from the weight loss. There's a little bit of LDL reduction from weight loss, maybe up to 10%.
Not
but
much.
There is a direct effect from the glucagon. PCSK9, potentially, what the mechanisms you've looked into.
And especially because it's working on the liver lipid metabolism, which is why glucagon agonism is going to be a big deal in fatty liver and, you know, MASH fibrosis stuff with some other drugs coming out. But that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So the, again, quick and dirty. So Lilly's looked into this. It messes with the lipoprotein lipase levels. It messes with what's called ANGPTL3/8 complexes. And then it also changes the regulation of the LDL receptor. So it's really like multiple ways that it's reducing LDL cholesterol. And again, that's way above this podcast. But there's definitely a mechanistic effect that you don't see with tirzepatide or semaglutide. So
very cool.
Now,
what about heart rate?
Yeah.
Everybody asks about heart rate.
Well, because all GLP-1 meds going all the way back to exenatide have been known to increase pulse a little bit without adverse effects by a few beats per minute or so on average. So yeah, what was that? That's a good question.
They did not have the heart rate data for TRIUMPH. They did for the diabetes, if you want to just transition to diabetes.
That's a good transition.
Like the heart rate increase in diabetics, it was only like 2 or 3 beats a minute. So
it's kind of the same as the GLP-1 receptor agonist. So, I guess let's talk about Transcend, right? Yes. In phase three type 2 diabetes trial. And the baseline of these patients with type 2 diabetes, what medications were they on? I just want to make sure I had that right, because I only just
let me pull that up. So this was actually really unique. They were not allowed to be on any other anti-hyperglycemics. So
that's what I thought. It's a total baseline, right? Yeah.
Yeah. They had to have a 90-day washout. And they actually said, you know, only 15% of these patients had ever been on an anti-hyperglycemic. I want to say the average time of diabetes was only about 2 years. So these were like very recent diabetic patients. And then they were, so this was same thing, either 4 milligrams, 9 milligrams, 12 milligrams. This included like intensive lifestyle and exercise, which you get to see with the placebo, cause they did get some weight loss and A1C reduction.
Yeah.
And this was only 40 weeks. So this was a pretty short trial. So this was 55% female, duration of type 2 diabetes, 2.5 years, A1C 7.9%, BMI was 36, and average glucose was 136. So not bad.
Average fasting glucose?
Yeah, average fasting glucose.
Was the average A1C almost 8 though?
Yeah, 7.9.
Okay, so yeah, I just made sure I confirmed myself to be before I said this. So that means their average blood sugars, for people listening, were in the basically 180 milligrams per deciliter. And, you know, normal fasting is below 100, and really normal 2-hour sugar is below 140. So 180 is kind of the upper end of where we want anybody to be, just even on average. But this was, or just... even after eating, but this was their average blood sugar.
Yeah.
All right. How'd they do?
So A1C reduction, 4 milligrams, 1.7%, and then 9 and 12, 1.9%. Placebo had 0.8%. The study authors did mention it was mostly postprandial benefit, because diet and exercise usually comes with postprandial more than anything else. Interestingly, so average A1C at the end of the trial was 6.2% for 4 milligrams, 6 for 9 milligrams, and 5.9 for 12 milligrams. And very interestingly, that there was not quite plateau on the A1C, which is interesting.
What was the average A1C? Because like you said, the placebo group, just for people out there, going down almost a 1% A1C with just diet and exercise and placebo, that's pretty good. So that's really what this good. Is being compared to. I mean, that's darn good. And so what was their A1C that it ended up?
At the end, it was 7.2.
Okay. So again, that's really darn good for people out there listening. If you have type 2 diabetes and that you're not on any medicine and you go from 8 down to, well, obviously that I could have figured that out by, again, math. Yeah. I guess if they improved 0.8%. So, but that's really darn good. And, but remarkable for the treatment group to get down almost normalizing their average sugars in just that short amount of time.
With no other medication allowed.
And
that's the thing I keep pointing out. Like, if you put metformin on these people, they're probably all essentially normal glycemic, is like even more normal glycemic than just Retta alone.
Those numbers are very similar to tirzepatide, but the tirzepatide trial obviously was different. The SURPASS trial.
One. I mean, it's, you know, that's the thing. I mean, obesity is already complex. Type 2 diabetes is complex, and the trials are done somewhat differently. At some point, I'm sure they're going to compare these two, and there's only so much you can go down. I mean, these were relatively early diagnosis. There are more trials coming where they have longer duration of diabetes, and that does get harder. And then, you know, in addition to other things, but that's pretty good. What about the weight loss? So like we talked about, weight loss trials for medications and diabetes are always a little bit lower amounts of overall weight loss compared to, say, pre-diabetes or no diabetes trials. But this one was pretty darn good still.
Yeah. So they were at, 12 milligrams was at 17, basically 17% weight loss at 40 weeks. 9 milligrams was at 15.5, and 4 milligrams was at 11.5. Placebo lost 2.5%. Just for comparison, in the initial SURPASS 1 of tirzepatide, the 15 milligram dose lost 11% of its body weight. So the 4 milligram, at least in terms of body weight reduction, was matching tirzepatide. None of those numbers were plateaued. They were still going down.
Is there a triumph too, meaning this is similar to SURPASS 1. So for people listening, Triumph 2, an actual obesity type 2 diabetes trial. Is that coming out?
Yeah. So Triumph 2 is the 80 week diabetes, and obesity trial. Yeah. It finished up like literally probably a couple weeks ago. And so that will be probably this fall. We'll get the full readout on that.
I bet that was 20%. I bet it's going to get 20%.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I mean, if I talk shop with you guys, if you put these patients on metformin or an SGLT2, I guarantee they'll hit 20%, because you'll get a little additive weight loss with those two medications. So, but even on its own, the slope looks like it's, you know, going to hit 20%.
Yeah. Let's talk clinically, because people are asking. Are you going to, so I'm looking at Retta, and again, I don't want to be naive and say, oh, this is a brand new medicine. There are people taking this already using the gray market research peptides.
I sure as hell wouldn't do that.
I wouldn't do it. I don't recommend it, crazy. But we got to be real in that there are a ton of people doing this. Usually these are like biohacker bodybuilder type of people, but there are some general population people just taking it.
But it's not from the real manufacturer, even though
they're like, oh, you guys are 3 years behind. It's like, yeah, because we're not going to give out research peptides and risk our licenses and
Do no harm first. Yeah, I mean, that's not how you do it. You don't give anybody.
But that's not the point here. The point is, people are going, okay, how are you going to use this? So I'm planning on using it in a lot of my patients who are on tirzepatide, who have a clinically meaningful amount of weight to still lose, and they are plateaued. And we have already exhausted all the non-GLP-1, the Qsymias, phentermines, topiramates, naltrexone, bupropion, metformins, et cetera, et cetera. So they're like, okay, what are you going to do? Just switch them over. It looks like the 4 milligram dose is similar to 10/15 milligrams. So I would probably plan on switching them over straight to the 4. However, Lilly may have their own protocols. I bet they're talking about this, and they may just say, no, just go ahead and start at the 2. That makes better tolerate it, because there may be some slight different toleration. You went from Retta to Terzi, and it was pretty much the same thing, but we're talking about the reverse, going from Terzi to Retta.
Well, and don't forget, or anything else. I mean,
or anything else, semaglutide. I mean, if you're going to go from semaglutide. Yeah.
I'm with you. I think going from 15 milligrams of tirzepatide to 4 milligrams of retatrutide sounds about right. But of course, we'll see what else comes out. You know, because at that point they've been exposed. You know, like the heart rate increase is usually when you start these drugs, right? Like the longer you're on them, your heart rate kind of, you know, comes back down, or it's not going to bump back up. You know, so yeah, I feel like that probably makes sense. You know, in the same way that, like, if you have a patient on 1 milligram of semaglutide, you can usually just switch them over to 5 of tirzepatide, or if they're on 2 milligrams, you can usually go 7.5 or 10, you know, and yeah, but also, you know, I feel like that's a patient provider conversation, you know. You know, if you've tolerated it really well, don't have a lot of side effects, then that might be easier. If you were one of those patients that just had every side effect under the world, maybe just restart at 2 milligrams and go from there. Yeah,
I'm probably going to do that conservatively at first, but I may have some patients that want to be a little bit more aggressive. We'll see when I get it. I don't know.
Yeah. And I think because we have all that maintenance trial data recently, that we can say, like, we're going to start you on a lower dose of a different medication, so you might regain some weight. Or you might, if they're diabetic, you might lose a little bit of A1C control for a minute, but, you know, as we titrate up, it's going to come right, you know, weight's going to come down and sugar's going to come right back down. So,
and as far as who's getting this, you know, from a clinical perspective, I mean, again, I think people need to realize this is a very powerful drug. Triple agonism. I mean, this is, you know, people are just taking it willy nilly out there from the gray market, which is, again, to me, kind of crazy. You know, this is, you know, if I kind of think back to our algorithm that we published last year, our ACE algorithm, we talk about the severity of disease really dictating the intensity of therapy, really should be reserved for those with more severe disease. Those who really, really need more than that 15% of weight loss to achieve blood sugar, cardio, you know, and we got to wait till the cardiovascular outcome trial, but, you know, the cardiometabolic benefits, the liver benefits, sleep apnea, knee arthritis, all that stuff. So, and then of course, cost. So we'll see how this plays out when it's ultimately approved.
Yeah, you're following the whole trying to treat it as a biologic in the FDA, right? Because of a number of amino acids connected. It has 39 amino acids. Is that correct? And it has to have.
Yeah, it has 39. Yeah.
So they're trying to, Eli Lilly, and people are upset because they're like, you just want it to be more expensive. They want it to be a biologic so people can't compound it.
Yeah, we don't want it to be expensive. That's not the point. We want it to be legitimate.
Eli Lilly is trying to protect their intellectual property, and people are like, well, peptides are natural. It's like they had to synthetically create this, and it's this retatrutide, retatrutide is not anywhere natural other than if you talk about agonism of these hormones in our body, but it's a completely synthetic drug.
Yeah, I mean, even insulin and the growth hormone analogs we have that are all legitimate peptides. They're all, you know, designed and manufactured and take a lot of effort to get them right for the newer ones.
So, and then here's another little thing that I'm getting questions on. Like, okay, you're saying let's stick with semaglutide and tirzepatide for most people and only use retatrutide for those with the more severe obesity. And they're like, why not take a lower dose of retatrutide? to what I would answer is that maybe we will be using that instead of tirzepatide and semaglutide. Yeah. We're waiting for that, our cardiovascular data. Yeah. If people are lowering their LDL cholesterol and liver fat,
and blood pressure, and everything's getting better,
and they start comparing them head to head, it's like, oh god, this, we might as well just put everybody in low dose. Then I'll do that.
Yeah. Maybe in a few years, everyone's just going to be on it.
Maybe a little bit of Retta. Everybody's a little.
Yeah. I have two points to add to that. One is that Lilly is running there's Triumph 8, which is only looking at the 2 milligram and 4 milligram dose. Obviously, we got a pretty decent idea of what 4 milligrams can do. But we don't know what 2 milligrams does. But as you guys just alluded to, like, maybe there is a place for lower BMI patients if they have cardiovascular issues to get some of that LDL lowering and blood pressure lowering, and then as far as cardiovascular outcomes, there's that trial's ongoing. There is Triumph 3, which also should be reporting out this summer. And that was Retta with patients with existing cardiovascular disease. And a BMI greater than 35. So basically, like, true morbid obesity trial with patients with cardiovascular disease, and what is it doing? So I think that'll also give us a hint as to, is this helpful for that subset with CVD?
Yeah. And hopefully we'll drive everyone else's costs down because if everything else, maybe that'll be the thing that helps figure it out.
Yeah. And I mean, with the biologic thing, I mean, I don't have any skin in that game, but, Pfizer presented their berobenatide, and it's 41 amino acids. And so they made a point yesterday to point out it's a biologic. But then they also said, we want to make sure that it's accessible to everybody. So I'm like, I think they were trying to be like, yes, it's a biologic, which for them is great. In terms of patent protection and no compounding, but then saying we want it to be accessible, at least suggesting they're not going to, price it like other biological drugs. So.
Very cool. Well, I think we've kind of gotten through most of it. We're probably going to have you back on the ADA. They've presented multiple receptor agonists and you've talked about amylin all the time. We're going to have to talk about that at some point here with the various amylin analogs that are out there.
And Kegra sent the data today. So,
oh, great.
Very, right. Very cool. Thanks for coming on. The future's bright. I think the costs are going to come lower. The number of these drugs that are coming out from various companies are throwing their hat in the ring. They all look kind of similar. And that's good. So we're not going to have this duopoly Novo and Lilly listen to this. We love you guys. You don't sponsor us, but we love you still.
Well, I'm getting like part-time work, doing education for them. Yeah. At least I got to work on the course.
David's probably going to, he's going to get some shill bucks at some point. He's got a glucagon.
I know. Good Lord.
Yeah.
Start selling those.
Yeah. Just mid seats.
I won't name I won't name the company, but they were like, oh, can we buy that design from you? And I was like,
nice.
No, like, this is just, I'm just having fun, guys. Like, let me have my fun.
Thanks so much for coming on. If you don't already follow David, he is on X, formerly known as Twitter. Flex MNP is your
handle there. Yeah.
Handle there. I don't think you have an Instagram, or you might probably don't do much there with you, but thanks so much for coming on. And if you have a family member, friend, someone who's interested in this new data around retatrutide and how it works and why everybody's really excited about it, make sure you send them this podcast. If you haven't rated us yet, go ahead and give us a rating on Spotify or Apple, the podcast. 5 out of 5. We'll find you if you don't.
Say hi to all my endocrine friends down there, who I told I'm not leaving West Michigan in the summer to go to New Orleans.
I'm not leaving.
It's brutally hot down here. That's for sure.
Very good. Here is our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities.